All right, we were going through the life of David, and no survey of the life of David would be complete without a study of David and Goliath. It may be perhaps the best known Bible story. Surveys have shown that people know the story of David and Goliath, non-church people, probably better than they know the story of the resurrection or any of the accounts of Jesus' own life. Next to a reference to Noah's Ark, David and Goliath is one of the most referenced Bible stories in all of literature and culture, simply because sports games, you know, the Division II school knocks off the Division I. It's David and Goliath. You know, everybody talks about David and Goliath and the battles associated with David and Goliath, but very few people actually are familiar with some of the details of the story. So, for example, everybody knows that David slung the sling and slew the giant Goliath with a sling stone, right, or slingshot. But it's amazing how many kids in modern America think of a slingshot as the pullback elastic. Oh, he hit him with a slingshot. No, he hit him with a sling. They don't even know the difference. And then, of course, my favorite is that everybody talks about David killing Goliath with the sling, but nobody talks about him chopping off his head and carrying his head back into the camp, into Saul's tent, right? And basically presenting it to Saul. Here you go. And then later on, it says what? He takes it to Jerusalem with him. Right? So, I'm not sure how anachronistic that is because, you know, Jerusalem is not the capital city of Israel at the time. So, it could mean one of two things, that they took it to the Jewish city near Jerusalem, or that later years, when David is king, the head of Goliath is still laying around somewhere, and David goes to get it, and he takes it to Jerusalem to him when he's king over Jerusalem. We know that when David runs from Saul, Goliath's armor is laid up in the temple precinct somewhere, and David takes that. So, you know, you don't see the picture of David carrying this massive head by the hair with the brains dripping out the bottom of it back to the tent of Saul. But there is a really good painting by Caravaggio, a realist, rationalist painter of the day. And if I'm not mistaken, I'm trying to remember which one it is. It's either David or Goliath is actually the artist himself. And I think it's Goliath, if I remember correctly. So people are familiar with the story. So familiar with the fact that if you've gone to church, you almost certainly have heard a sermon on David and Goliath. What kind of sermons have you heard? Feedback time. David and Goliath. How have you heard it preached? Okay. There's the moralistic perspective, but usually it's pretty thinly done. Goliath is the giant that represents your problems in life. So he's the giant of, you know, your bad marriage or your bad job or the giant of your feelings towards your parents or, you know, Goliath represents whatever problem you're having at the moment that's standing in the way of you having a happy, fulfilling life. So you have to kill the giant, all right? The solution is usually what in that kind of a sermon? Well, how does David kill Goliath? Come on, Daniel, we talked about this once. You got to find your five stones. You know, the stone of faith, the stone of perseverance, the stone of truth, justice in the American way. Yeah, right. You know, it's all allegorized, basically, is what it comes down to. How else have you heard the story of David and Goliath preached? Which is not bad, necessarily. Go through the story, pick out some points of how David trusted in God. That's kind of what we're going to do this morning, in some respects. So it's not necessarily bad. Depends how it's done. Yeah. And again, that's not totally wrong, because the text does indicate David has confidence that he's able to handle Goliath, as he's killed a lion. And we're going to talk about courage this morning as well, although we're going to put it in its proper context. Then there's always some of the typological sermons. And again, depending how it's done, could be right, could be wrong. David is a type of Christ. Goliath is a type of Satan or sin or something of that nature. I think there can be some validity to that depending on how it's done. If you want to take it as pure allegory, that this is really an allegory of Jesus and Satan, I think you probably have some problems. But what you wanted to say is, okay, David is the progenitor of Christ, and evil in the world, satanic influences in the world, is what, you know, in other words, that this is a spiritual battle between David and Goliath, which, again, we're going to talk about this morning. I think there's some validity to that. Okay. Our approach this morning is to say this. That when you read this story, what you're seeing is a young man who sees the battle with Goliath differently than everybody else that he talks to. The way the chapter breaks out, it's a long chapter, by the way. If you have a paper Bible with you, you know, my chapter 17 starts on the right-hand facing page. But you flip the page, and what you get is you get two whole more facing pages. You're still going through David and Goliath. You flip the page, the whole left-hand side is still David and Goliath. This is 58 verses long. It's a long chapter. Well, the fact that there's this much information devoted to the story should tell us that it's an important story. All right, let's do some background. The story breaks out this way. It gives us a whole lot of background information. Kind of explains how we got where we are. And really, the main points don't begin until a little bit further down in the chapter, about verse 25 or 26. And the whole first part of it is background. So I'm just going to zip through that real quick. First of all, back in chapter 16, David was selected by Saul to be in his entourage. Okay, so Saul is king. Saul has periods of spiritual depression because of his rebellion, because, you know, he's been abandoned. The Spirit of God and the influence of the Spirit is no longer in Saul's life. David is brought in because he plays well. And the chapter closes with David being selected to be one of Saul's armor bearers. That does not mean he is the armor bearer. Okay? Joab has 10 armor bearers. What it means is that David is a armor bearer, and for his young age, it could very well mean that he was an armor polisher, right? Or an armor packer, of something pretty low down the totem pole. So that Saul has taken notice of him because of his skillful playing. And he says, yeah, I'd like to have find a job for this kid so he can stick around when I need him. And so what job did they find? Here you go. Polish this guy's shield. Something like that. What we learn in chapter 17 is that David goes back and forth. He spends time in Saul's court. He goes back home to his father Jesse. He goes back and spends time with Saul's court. Goes back and spends time with his father Jesse. And he's still just a young kid, relatively speaking. Of course, in chapter 16, he's been anointed by Samuel to be Saul's replacement, which I find interesting. That young David knows he's going to be Saul's replacement, and yet he still ministers to Saul by singing to him spiritual songs on the harp. Okay, so then chapter 17 opens up with this battle that's going to start taking place. Verses 2 and 3 describes how Saul and the men of Israel are camped together on one hillside or one mountainside, and the Philistines stood on the mountain on the other side, and there's this valley between these two armies. Why are the mountains on the mountainside, are the armies on the mountainsides? Why aren't they down in the valley? Why isn't one of them down in the valley? Strategy. You don't want to be in the valley. You want to have the high ground. You want to make the other guy run up to you, right? Okay. The other thing you have to realize about battles in those days is, you know, you get the opinion that is, or the, you know, Hollywood gives you the idea that as soon as all the armies arrive, then the very next day there's a battle. Or that as soon as they line up and start cheering and ranting, and then immediately there's a battle and everybody runs together down into the valley. No, that's not the way it works. These guys would come out and they would set their armies up in line. And the other army would set theirs up in line, and then they'd look at each other, hurl insults, whatever. But they're all lined up for battle. The men are all pumped, you know, adrenaline going, but the generals are looking how their army lines up with that army. And if they don't like it, they don't do anything. Everybody breaks down, goes home, you know, and the next day we do it all over again. Or maybe we wait a day or two. And we might try getting up at 5 in the morning and getting our troops ready. And we'll watch and see. You know, the Israelites get up at 5 in the morning or 3:30 in the morning or whatever. Did the Philistines promptly respond? And the whole time they're doing this, they're gauging each other. If I move my chariot, you know, platoon, call it whatever it is, over here to the left, how did they respond? What does he do? And the best analogy I can give for this is football. Modern-day football, the offensive linemen come out and they get where they're going to go. And they're not allowed to move. But what offenses have adopted are all of these shifts and motion. And what's going on is they're not trying to escape necessarily. The quarterback is watching. So when the tight end out of the T position shifts back and then comes across to the other side of the line and sets here, who follows? Is it the inside linebacker, the outside linebacker, or the safety? Or did the defensive end get up and follow? Where's my matchups? When my wide receiver goes in the motion, who's tracking him? Is it a defensive back, cornerback, safety? Where are my matchups? And the quarterback is looking for mismatches. He's looking for Rob Gronkowski, you know, on a cornerback who's 6 inches, 8 inches shorter than he is. Because all they need is half a step and a 2 feet window or a 1 foot window for some of them. That's all they want. That's all they need. They're looking for mismatches. Well, that's what the Philistines and the Israelites are doing, and they do it for at least 40 days. Because for 40 days, Goliath comes out and he taunts Israel. So every time they line up, now imagine just being a soldier. And you go out there and you're all lined up and you're all pumped and you're ready for battle and you're doing the chant. You know? And the order comes down, shift this column, you know, 500 paces to the left. And so you do that. And he's watching over there and you don't know, is this going to be the day we actually attack or not? And for over 40 days you do that and nothing happens. This, by the way, is how some of the greatest battles in ancient history have been won and lost. Alexander the Great and Darius and the Persians in this great battle where the Persians outnumber the Greeks more than 2-1. And Alexander the Great figures out what to do in this time period. So when the battle actually commences, he takes his army, and instead of marching straight at the Persians, he says, guys, we're going to walk this way. Which sounds stupid because it's exposing your flank, but he's got that taken care of. And so as he starts walking this way, the reason he's doing it, because there's level ground over here where the Persians are, and their greatest weapon is their chariot forces. And Alexander the Great says, I'll take them out of play. We're going over here where the ground isn't level. Because for the last several days I've noticed when we did this, they didn't do that. And so that's what he does. And sure enough, he winds up winning the battle. Julius Caesar in Pompeii. Similar situation. He notices how Pompeii has these cavalry that are a little bit over-eager over here on what would be Caesar's right flank. And so they make adjustments. And when the battle actually starts, Caesar sends his most seasoned men to the right flank, hidden behind a hill. And so the other guys attack. The cavalry comes just like before. These guys retreat. Pompey thinks he's won. By the way, he outnumbers Caesar 3-1. Easy. These guys retreat. The cavalry charges head on into a trap and gets destroyed. And then Caesar's most seasoned men, after destroying Pompey's cavalry on the right flank, just stand up, come around the right flank, and start attacking from the side. And Pompey's army's just like dominoes because they're all facing this way and they're now getting attacked from this way. This strategy of waiting for the right mismatch is what's going on here. And in this time frame, Goliath makes his appearance and is issuing his challenges. Verses 4 through 7, we get something about Goliath's appearance. He is 9 feet, some odd inches tall, probably about 9'3". We're told he has a helmet of bronze, which would not only be better at absorbing blows than iron, particularly if you're the one wearing it, but it could be polished and make you look a little bit more fearsome. A coat of mail in verse 5. Don't think of chain mail. That's a medieval knight. Do what? Scale mail. Think more of the samurai armor than the medieval knight armor. Okay? But probably weighed about 125 to 150 pounds. Again, bronze. A javelin of bronze, verse 6. The Hebrew word probably refers not so much to something you would throw as to something you would thrust with. There are two swords that Goliath would have had. One of them would have been the large sword, the overhead strike, where out of sheer, it doesn't even have to be sharp, just out of sheer force, you just crumple your enemy in front of you. And with Goliath's size, that would have been very easy to do. One strike would have just shattered your skeleton, even if it doesn't even break the skin, that kind of a thing. The thing between his shoulder blades in verse 6 is most likely similar to a short sword. Somewhat similar, but not exactly the same idea of what the Romans used. It's made for thrusting at close quarters. His spear in verse 7 is about probably 5 or 6 inches in diameter. It's It's a weaver's beam. The weight of the spearhead is somewhere around 12 to 15 pounds. And if everything is proportional, the spear would have been probably 20 feet long. Yes, and that's the whole idea. How do you get at this guy? Okay, you know, you want to do the Indiana Jones 357 thing, right? Just boom. But yeah, you don't have the 357. If you get within, 40 feet of him maybe, 30 feet, the spear's coming at you, and it's so heavy, it's going to go through any armor you have. I mean, it's an armor-piercing weapon is what his spear is. He's got a guy walking in front of him holding the shield. How'd you like to be that guy? Right. Probably doesn't have a weapon, by the way. Because when Goliath falls down, David rushes over and takes Goliath's sword. Nobody stops him. Not the shield bearer going in front of him. So most likely when Goliath falls, the shield bearer, who doesn't have a weapon, that would be shameful for Goliath anyway, for the guy bearing the shield to do the fighting. He probably takes off. He drops the shield and he's gone. Right? But still, this guy's out in front. First line of defense. So he's cut by the plate mail, probably goes down to the knees, and then his bronze greaves, cover from his just below his knees down to his feet. Okay, so he's got a spear that'll get you from, say, 30 feet out, go through armor. He's completely armored and plated. He's got a shield in front of him. He's got something for close quarter fighting. How do you beat this guy? Theoretically, according to the tactics of the day, he shouldn't have been able to be defeated. That's just all there is to it. Goliath's challenge basically is recorded for us in verses 8 through 10. Verse 8, why do you come out to battle? And I take that to mean, why are you even bothering? You guys are so pitiful, you servants of Saul, right? Why are you even bothering with this? And since it's basically a matter of foregone conclusion, we'll just have a battle, you and me. This is a typical thing, by the way. One champion versus another champion. The matter can be decided in one solitary battle. By the way, it was never really decided in one solitary battle. Even when that was the challenge and when the challenge was accepted, there is never an instance in history of the army of the losing champion going, oh, well, we made a deal, okay. And laying down all their swords and all their armor and going, okay, we're your slaves, we made a deal. It doesn't happen that way. Even here, the Philistines do what? They run. They don't lay down all their, okay, guys, we said we'd be your slaves. We're your slaves. What do you want done today? It doesn't work. Verse 8, Goliath refers to himself as a Philistine. Probably referring to himself as a commoner. But he doesn't refer to the Israelites as Israelites. He refers to them as servants of Saul. And this is an interesting idea. Philistine government, there were five major cities of the Philistine League. Each city was governed by a lord. But the Philistines themselves were governed by a council of these five lords coming together and voting. It's not exactly democracy. It's more like chieftain cooperation than anything else. But Saul is a solitary monarch king. And Goliath is basically referring to the Israelites as slaves of a dictator. Okay. There is some irony in that, isn't there? I mean, they don't have democracy. You don't vote for the lord of your city. So this is not democracy. Probably the way Afghanistan used to be run before American intervention is a pretty good approximation to what the Philistines were doing. there were local chieftains. It was a birth thing, generally speaking, passed down. And so the chieftains would come together and they would vote as to whether they were going to cooperate or not. Verse 10, Goliath defies Israel. It's an insult, not just a challenge. Basically, he is charging Israel with cowardice. I defy you, you bunch of belittled, demeaning, or demeaned cowards, you. The setting in verses 12 through 24, we've talked about some of this. David is going back and forth between Saul and Jesse. The background, Jesse sends David to check on his oldest sons. He sends food to him, food to the commander. When David arrives, it's one of those times where the battle lines are being drawn up and the generals are gauging each other for weaknesses. And Goliath comes out and again issues a challenge. So David takes the stuff he's brought with him, the cargo. He leaves it with somebody in charge. And he runs into the ranks of the soldiers to find his brothers. And he's talking to them as Goliath has come out and issued this challenge. So that's the setting, okay? So if you can picture that, here's this, how old is David? Nobody knows, but he's probably a teenager. A teenage boy running into the ranks of these soldiers lining up for battle. Then we get to the actual main point. All of that's background. All of that's introduction. The main point starts there in verse 25. And what you get is you get David reacting differently from everybody else he talks to. Goliath issues his challenge. David acts one way. Everybody else acts differently. And what you're meant to get from this story is this question. Why does David react differently from everybody else? Or maybe the better way of saying it is, why does everybody else react differently than David does? Okay. So let's look at some of the reactions David gets. First, verses 25 and 26, the soldiers. Okay, so Goliath has come out, he's issued his challenge. Verse 25, the men of Israel said, speaking to David, "Have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. And it shall be that the man who kills him, the king will enrich him with great riches, will give him his daughter and give his father's house exemption in Israel." All right? Let's talk about the soldiers for a moment. What is their perspective on what's going on? How are they looking at it? What are they thinking about? Yeah. And what is that reward? Let's break it out. There's no taxation for you and your family. And that's a permanent thing. Okay, remember one of the things that Samuel warned the Israelites about? You make a king, what's he going to do? He's going to start taxing you. In this short amount of time, taxation has become such a concern among the people that being free is a tremendous advantage. So already Samuel's prophecy about what the king would do has happened. Saul's already started taxing the people. And they're thinking, hey, you, your family, your lineage could be free of taxation. Okay, that's one. What's the other reward?
Influence.
There's influence. The king's daughter, which makes you royalty, a prince. You are now part of the royal family. Okay, it also puts you in line to the throne. What else? the simple one. It's the first one it made mention of. Riches, money. Money, 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 money. Okay. So how are they looking at this situation? Materialistic eyes. This battle to them is about one thing and one thing only. Yeah. Money. Capital. Who gets to keep their farms? The Philistines or us? Who gets to keep the house? Who's going to come out of this with money? And oh, by the way, if somebody actually were to kill this Philistine, oh, the money he could get, the royal influence, part of the royal family, possibly in line to the throne, free of taxation, him and his whole lineage. Wow. Very materialistic. What's wrong with that perspective? Ah, okay. Let's look at David's response in the very next verse, 26. David spoke to the men who stood by him, saying, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" What does David not mention? The reward. Okay? So David isn't thinking about marrying Michael or becoming a son-in-law to the king or money or prestige. He's not thinking about that at all. How does he look at Goliath? How did the soldiers refer to Goliath? Verse 25. Yeah, but what do they call him? They never refer to his nationality in verse 25. I'm sorry, the man. Have you seen this man? Okay. How does David refer to him? And uncircumcised here is not the, just is. Well, okay, he's not in the covenant. He's not one of God's. So what does that make Goliath? This Philistine. He's an idol worshiper. He's a pagan. He's an idolater. He does not know God. Okay? So David is looking at this not from materialistic eyes, but with spiritual eyes. He's thinking of Goliath not as an opportunity for reward. He's thinking of Goliath as an enemy of God. David's statement in verse 26 is not just a repetition of what he has heard from the others. It's a one-up. Oh, what will be done for the man that kills? Oh, he'll have great riches, marry the king's daughter, free from taxation. Oh, can you imagine the reward? And David goes, oh, what's going to be done? This guy's an uncircumcised Philistine. If you're thinking of monetary rewards for killing a man, what greater reward than slaying one of God's own enemies? Okay, now, what will be done for that man who kills one of God's enemies? So David is thinking of, I think, reward in a sense, but not materialistic. He's pointing them towards the spiritual issue. Well, what will be done for the man that kills one of God's enemies? Forget about this man. What would happen to somebody who kills an uncircumcised Philistine who's defying God? And what he's doing is he's challenging the soldiers to think about this differently than they do. All right. So then we run into number two. By the way, this perspective, thinking about the rewards, would normally speaking, would you expect somebody to get up and show the courage to go fight Goliath with the perspective that the soldiers have? Look at what you could get. But do you really expect someone to take on the challenge of fighting Goliath when that's their perspective? And the answer that I come up with is, no, I really don't. You know why? Because if what you're concerned about is earthly things, you're weighing what are the odds that I actually get to enjoy those earthly things. And okay, yeah, I might stand out in the middle of the road and do a shootout with somebody that I think I can beat if there's money on the line. But if I don't think I can beat this guy at all, in fact, if I'm pretty sure I can't, I'm not risking my skin, even if there is a lot of money involved. Okay. There's a whole bunch of money in Fort Knox. I don't think I'm going to go shoot my way in there anytime soon. Okay. Well, there's a whole lot of money for killing Goliath, but you know what? I ain't going out there to get it. So the perspective of the soldiers will never lead any of them to volunteer in this situation. But David's perspective, this guy is defying God. God made a covenant with us. We are God's people. He's not insulting us. He's insulting God. Oh. That changes things. All right. Who's next in line? Verses 28 and 29. Now who does David interact with? His brother, his oldest brother, Eliab. Okay, what's Eliab's perspective? David, why are you even here? Okay. Let me break it out for you. Eliab in verse 28. Basically, why are you here? What, David, what reason do you have to be here? You don't belong here. Well, you're not only talking smack, but you don't belong here. You shouldn't be here. By the way, does David have a good reason for being there? His dad sent him. Okay. With food for the brothers to find out how the brothers are doing. There's a parallel, I think, here. Okay? So, get the story in your head, all right? An old man sends a younger brother who has been spiritually favored of God to go take food and check up on the older brothers who respond instead with hatred and envy. What other story does this remind you of? Joseph. Okay, the writer is intentionally drawing out parallels, I think, between David and Joseph. How did Joseph's brothers look at Joseph himself? How did Reuben and Judah and the others look at Joseph? Here comes this dreamer. Right? They hate him. I'll tell you what. Let's kill him, and then we'll see what becomes of his dreams. Okay? Now, what was Joseph's dream? That God was going to elevate him, bless him, and make him ruler. What has just happened to David in chapter 16? God is going to bless him, elevate him, and make him ruler. Okay? You have to take that into account, because it explains Eliab's reaction to David. Who was the first son of Jesse that Samuel thought would be Saul's replacement that God says, no, not him? Bingo. Eliab. Now, I don't know how much Jesse and his sons knew at that time, but I think it becomes pretty apparent by the end of the story when David kneels down and Samuel breaks out the horn of oil and anoints David, it's pretty obvious what's going on. It should be pretty obvious to Eliab that Eliab, the eldest, the tallest, the biggest, stands before Samuel, and Samuel gets this look on his face like, wow, the next, and then all of a sudden goes, No, not him. Now we get the interaction between these two brothers, Eliab and David. Okay? Why are you even here? You don't belong here. Just like Joseph's brothers assumed that Joseph was there to spy on them, so Eliab is indignant about David even being there. With whom have you left those few sheep? Well, David has left the sheep with somebody who's watching them, but Eliab is accusing him of being a rebellious little punk who's just come out to see the show. Okay? But then he says, Eliab does in verse 28, we find it towards the end there. I know your pride and the insolence of your heart. The ESV instead of pride has presumption. And I think another translation has arrogance. And it's a good idea here. Eliab is saying that David presumes that he has a right to be there. I know you think you have a right to be here, but you don't. That's how to summarize Eliab's attitude towards David. Why are you even here? You shouldn't be here. I know you think you have a right to be here, but you don't. Why would Eliab say to David, I know your presumption. You think you have a right to be here, but you don't. Because he was anointed. And Eliab knows it. David, just because you got some oil on your head by an old grizzled beard prophet, you think you belong here. You should be back watching the sheep. Okay? David has served as Saul's armor bearer, but basically what was that? Armor polisher? Armor carrier, armor packer, right? You know, squirt, third class. Not even squire. Squire is still a, you know, the people who sign esquire. That's the longer form of squire. Even that is a position of rank. This is below squire. This is below squire's peon. This is peon to the peon. That's the way I look at it anyway. Because Saul doesn't even, at the end of this, Saul doesn't even remember David. Who is this kid? He's the guy that you asked to come serve in your court to play the harp. He's Jesse's, you know, that's what David tells him. I'm the son of your servant Jesse. Saul doesn't even remember him. Now, Saul's not exactly in a great frame of mind. Okay, and when David does come in to play the harp, I'm sure Saul isn't thinking about David. So give him that. But the whole point is that David doesn't exactly have an important position in Saul's court. And then he gets anointed, and Eliab goes, you think you have a right to be here? Okay? David's response. Verse 29. Okay. Oh, first of all, how would you characterize Eliab's response? What's one word you would choose to summarize Eliab's attitude towards David? Okay. He is scornful. What? Resentful. I'm going to throw out the word envious. Jealous, I'm mad at you because you're going to take what I have. Envious, I'm mad at you because I want what you have. Okay? Envious. He is envious of David. And when you're envious of somebody, what do? You belittle them. Right? So, when you're secretly envious of the basketball star in high school, what do? You tell everybody else how stupid he is. Yeah, okay, so what? He can stand there and dunk the ball. But he's dumber than a bag of rocks. Right? You you belittle him, you demean him. Oh, he's just some arrogant fool who thinks he's entitled to everything. This is Eliab with David. Envy is coming out. David's response, okay? Two things. What have I done? Okay, Eliab, tell me what it is that I've done that is so wrong. David basically challenges his older brother. You accuse me of doing something wrong. Tell me what it is I've done wrong. David left the sheep with a watcher. He left the cargo that he carried from his father in the hands of somebody who's going to watch over it. He's there because his father sent him. Okay, what have I done wrong? But then the last part of verse 29, and it depends on how you translate it. King James and New King James has, is there not a cause? ESV says, was it not but a word, or was it not only a word? And it's because you've got this Hebrew word, dabar, which is about as vague as you can get. Dabar can mean anything from word to speech to thing. Yeah, a rock or something. So it can mean cause or matter, okay, but it can mean just thing. It can refer to just a very generic item or point of discussion, thing, but it can also refer to a word or speech or something you're talking about. So I'm not going to solve the issue for you. I'll just say this. The Hebrew does not have a word for only or but. Okay? Literally, is not a thing it is or it. There is no is, actually. There is no verb. And there's like three Hebrew words, and when you try to put them together in your head, they don't really make sense. But there is no word for only. So when the ESV or other translations have, was it not only a word, or was it not but a word? The word but or only is not there in the Hebrew, so it has to be supplied. And there are lots of instances where Hebrew doesn't give you the verb. But or only is a pretty important word, and there's nothing that corresponds to that in the Hebrew. So I tend to go for the King James Version translation. If it means, is there not a cause, then what David is doing is he's challenging his older brother to think about this from the perspective of the cause at hand. Stop being envious, Eliab, and start thinking about this from the perspective of the cause at hand. What I said, there's a reason for saying it. Okay? In a sense, what he's asking Eliab to do is to say, what I just said to these guys right here that you overheard, tell me, what was wrong with what I said? Is there wrong information? Is it theologically in error? Is there something morally or ethically wrong? Okay, there's a reason why I said this. Okay. If it's the latter, if you go with the ESV translation, was it not only a word? Then what David is basically saying is, look, all I did was talk. I haven't done anything yet. Okay, maybe that's what he means, but I'll leave it up to you. The summation is this. Eliab acts out of envy. Envy always demeans the object of its envy in order to bring it down to my level. You're up here. I wish I was up there. I can't get up there, so I'm going to bring you down here, which is what Eliab is doing to David at this point. Will envy ever go out and fight the giant, so to speak? Because what? It knows it can't. Okay? I can't tell you how many times I've seen young preachers who want to be just like John MacArthur go into the ministry and then wind up washing out because guess what? They're not John MacArthur. Okay? Eliab is not David. Eliab, out of envy, is never going to act like David. That's not necessarily a bad thing, except that Eliab can't handle it. All right? So, all right, David's response to all of this is basically truth. Look, he doesn't respond back to Eliab, look, you're just a hulking mass of stupidity. You know, Eliab, you're so dumb. How dumb is he? You are so dumb. He doesn't get back into an argument. He doesn't defend himself. He just simply says, look, let's think about what has really happened here. I haven't done anything morally wrong. I haven't said anything, you know, incorrect. And there's a reason for me being here. And there's a reason for me to say what I said. That's pretty good. I get attacked. Man, I want to kill the, you know, you just want to bite the head off. Throw them on the floor. You get attacked. Your first reaction is always to just, David doesn't do that. It's amazing. Okay? All right, third one is Saul. So David has said this. Now he says it to some other soldiers. In verse 31, Saul hears about it. The words were heard. They get reported back to Saul. Saul goes, wow, we got somebody who really wants to do this? Really? And up comes David, and verse 32, he says, let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine. Now notice he doesn't say, I will go. Your servant. I'm acting on your behalf. In other words, he's phrasing in a way where Saul can still get the glory out of all of this thing. I'm just Saul's servant. That's what the Philistine said. I'm your slave. I'll go do this at your order, at your command. He's still recognizing Saul's kingship and kingly authority. Your servant will go and do this. And Saul says to David in verse 33, you're not able. Okay, what is Saul looking at? All right? What he can see. Empirical evidence, if I can put it that way. You're a runt. You're a kid. This guy has been a soldier. Now, Saul is concluding that the battle depends solely on combat skills and equipment. The only way we're going to win this is if we get somebody bigger, stronger, meaner, tougher, with better equipment. Okay? And you're not meaner, tougher, better equipped. David, you can't win. He doesn't demean David, by the way. You give this to Saul. Saul's not ridiculing David. He's just simply saying the battle is going to be decided solely on the basis of war. And there's no way you can win. So it definitely shows that Saul isn't thinking spiritually, but at least Saul isn't demeaning David like David's brother Eliab did. So let's give Saul some credit here. David's response to Saul. Okay. There's the I've done this before, but even when he says that, verse 34, your servant used to keep his father's sheep, a lion or bear came, da-da-da-da-da-da. Verse 37, David said, the Lord, Yahweh, the I am of Moses' burning bush. The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. Okay. So, Saul, you're looking at the empirical evidence as a warrior. The better warrior is going to win. I'm not the better warrior. I can't win. And David says, wait a minute, the Lord has already done this, this, and this for me. The same God who did this will do this for me. The battle is not going to be decided by empirical evidence. The battle is going to be decided by the Lord. And what is Saul's response? The Lord be with you. Let's give Saul some credit. Okay. Saul at that moment, I think, why in the world does Saul let him go? And I've heard all kinds of guesses. Saul is scared. Saul was the tallest. Saul should have gone and fought with Goliath. Kings never go out and do that. Kings never accept champions' challenges unless it's the other king. And Goliath is not king. So, no, Saul should not have accepted that challenge. There's no way. It just was not done. Is Saul scared? I don't think so. I think he might be scared about his army and the morale, and he doesn't know what to do. But I don't think Saul is scared. I don't think he sends David out of fear. I don't think he sends David out of jealousy. This giant's going to kill David, and then I'm done with David. I don't think Saul's at that point in his life yet. I honestly think David says to Saul, God is going to win this battle, and Saul says, you're right. The Lord be with you. And he sends him out. Now, he still tries to give him armor. And David goes, no, I can't do this. This is just, I'm not tested with it, whatever. And then you know the rest of the story. But I really do think that David's influence on Saul here is similar to David's influence when he sings for Saul. Saul is in his right mind at this moment. Okay, you're right. The Lord be with you. And he lets him go. There's one last interaction that David has. And that's with Goliath. Okay, Goliath is insulted. Am I a dog that you come out to me with sticks? Right? Verse 43. Last part of verse 43. And the Philistine, right, cursed David by his gods. Don't overlook this. Why does Goliath think he's going to win? Because of his gods. Goliath is convinced that his gods are going to give him the victory. Okay. About, and the timeline is fuzzy, but about 50, maybe 60 years ago, there was this event that happened. It's recorded for us in 1 Samuel 4. It's before Saul is king. Eli is the priest. They're fighting, getting ready to fight the Philistines. The Israelites bring the Ark of the Covenant out to the camp. There's a huge shout. The earth shakes. The Philistines are quaking in their sandals. The same God that destroyed Egypt, the same God that brought these Israelites into this land, he's now in the camp. We're done for. Fine. I'm going to go down fighting. And then they win. 30,000 Israelites are dead before the battle is over. And the rest of them go limping back home. Keep that in mind. Okay? The Ark of the Ark of the Covenant is taken. What happens? Do y'all remember the story? Yeah, you've got probably what amounts to some form of bubonic plague going through the cities. But what happens before that? Yes. Dagon. Okay. Dagon, or Dagon, if you know, Dagon. Almost. That's almost how the Hebrew is pronounced. The first part of that word, dog, is interesting because it's the Hebrew word for fish. Okay, so the Hebrew word for fish is dog. Just remember that. Yeah. The God is half fish, half man. Okay, because the Philistines depend upon the sea for their military might and for their commerce and trade and for their food. They are sea peoples. Okay, so they worship a half man, half fish. What better mediator between you and the gods of the sea than somebody who's half you and half sea? Right? Kind of like what kind of better mediator between you and God than maybe somebody who's half God and half man? That would be the pagan way of looking at it. Well, this is the way they look at their religion. Okay. So what happens to Dagon? First he falls over. They set him up, falls over, and then he's in half, broken in half, right? There's the fishy part that's still up there, and the man part is bowed down. All right? So then they start sending the ark around. People look into it. Then we get the tumors and the rats and the whole bubonic plague thing. We got to get rid of this ark. So somebody gets the idea, take two calves, right, that should go to their mom. Let them draw this cart, put the ark on the cart, and let it go. Now, if they come back to us again, then we'll know this was all just coincidence. But if they magically go back away to Israel, then we'll know that God had done this, and that's exactly what happens. And the Philistines all repented and became Christians. Fifty years later, the story has been mistold, obliterated. History has been reconstructed, okay, by the Philistine professors, right? The history books have all been rewritten. It's all been revised, yeah, revisionism, and Goliath is persuaded that his gods are stronger. And there's this sense of, I'm going to beat you. I curse you by my gods. I'm going to kill you today. I'm going to feed you to the dogs and the birds. Here's what's funny to me. David says the same thing to Goliath. I'm going to kill you. I'm going to chop off your head. And I'm going to give you to the birds and to the beasts. But David responds by saying, God is going to do this. Okay? So Goliath is looking at this as a spiritual battle, and so is David. The only two people that understand this thing properly are David and Goliath. That's ironic to me. The only two guys in this battle who understand this battle properly as a spiritual issue are David and Goliath. Goliath is courageous because he's persuaded his gods are going to win. And David is courageous because he's persuaded his God will win. Now, David has something that we don't. Anytime you hear a sermon on this that says, you need to be as courageous as David. Okay, David just got anointed king. He knows he's going to be king someday. All right? Unless God lied or unless the religion of God is false, David is invincible until he becomes king. Now, there's still an element of faith, but it's faith in a very specific revealed word from God's prophet. Okay, this is not faith in faith. Okay, this is not something that David says, I believe. I can kill this giant. How do you know? Because I just believe I can. I believe I can. I know I can. I think I can. This is not self-hypnosis, self-help. This is not that kind of name it and claim it kind of faith that's going on here. David already has been promised by God specifically that he is going to be king one day. And David is simply persuaded God doesn't break his promises. So, I'm invincible. Okay, You and I don't have that kind of a promise. Okay? You cannot go out with just a slingshot on the fields of Afghanistan trying to defeat the Muslim hordes in a spiritual battle. Okay, this does not apply to you directly the way it applies to David. Okay, because he has a word or a promise. There are promises given to us, but they're not as specific as David's in that sense of the word, particularly regarding our earthly life. I am promised I will be conformed to the image of Christ. It may be by God letting me be stupid and suffering the consequences and learning the hard way. But I'll still be conformed to the image of Christ. Okay? I have a promise that if I resist the devil, he will flee from me. I do not have a promise as to how long that will take and how much resistance and sweat and blood will be involved. It's not like I can say no to temptation one time and Satan's going to run away with his tail between his legs. Okay? Goliath didn't do that with David. So there are some generic, I say generic, there are some promises of the word given to us regarding eternal life, glory, all of these things. Nothing bad, spiritually bad, can ever happen to one of God's people. But David does have some very specific promises about the course of his earthly life that you and I don't have. Keep that in mind next time you hear a sermon where David is just whole hog taken and applied to you, and the theme of the sermon is, why aren't you more like David? It's kind of like, why aren't you like Paul the Apostle? Because I haven't seen Jesus Christ on the road to Damascus. Okay? Hello? There are some differences here. And they are extremely important ones. But Goliath and David are the only ones who see this as a spiritual battle. All right. So, it's exactly what happens, is what David says is what happens. He says, I'm going to cut off your head. I assume, as most people do, that the stone actually kills Goliath. If Goliath is wearing a helmet of bronze, the forehead is almost surely covered. So by the Hebrew word forehead, we're referring to anything that basically is the upper half of the head. That rock almost surely did not hit Samson up on the top of the crown of the forehead. It probably hits him like square between the eyes. And because of the nasal cavity that's back here, I mean, if you've ever seen a skeleton, when the nose is gone, what's behind the nose? Nothing. Yeah, it's brain. Right? They need to do brain surgery. Where do they go nowadays? They go up your nose and through that cavity to get to the brain, because then I don't have to cut any bone to get there, especially for the pituitary gland. Okay, so they go up through the nose, and that's how they do the surgery. Well, if the rock hits right there at high velocity, not only is there a whole lot of blood, which is really cool, right? Because, everybody sees this blood spurting everywhere. But probably would have gone right through that nasal opening back to the brain. That's the way I look. I can't prove that. But it would seem to me that if Goliath is wearing a helmet, you know, there's not an opening here with a target that says, hit me, you know, on the floor right here. Most likely this is covered. Okay? So probably like right between the eyebrows or top of the nose, that kind of a place, something like that. Is he dead? Probably. But I kind of like to think that maybe he was a little alive just long enough to see David stand over him with a sword. I can't prove that. That's just my personal thoughts. But it would be really cool if Goliath's last vision, last sight of this earth was this little punk kid standing over top of him, pulling his own sword out or picking it up off the ground and whoosh, bringing it down. Okay. What do we learn from this account? Everything is a spiritual issue. The soldiers were thinking of it monetarily. They're capitalists, right? Eliab is envious. He's thinking of himself. Saul, at first, is thinking like a general. Okay? Give him credit. That's positive. It's better than the other two. Okay? And David constantly confronts them from a spiritual perspective. It isn't about reward. It's about the fact that this guy's the enemy of God. It isn't about envy, Eliab, and your own personal feelings. This is about truth. Saul, with all respect, I am your servant, but the battle is the Lord's, and the Lord who delivered me from the hand of the lion and bear will deliver this Philistine. And Saul is convinced. Goliath and David are the only two who start off from this whole thing from the perspective that it's a battle of gods drawn out in the lives of men. Everything is a spiritual issue. So this morning we talked about politics some at the table, right? Whether it's abortion, gun control, income equalization, socialism, justice, the Me Too movement, whatever you hear about or think about on the news, you need to think of it as a spiritual issue. Good friend of mine has drilled this mantra into his congregation's head. Everything is disciplined by theology, or theology disciplines all things. And what he means by that is it doesn't matter what it is. Taxes, your home life, your children, your dog, everything, your job. Your money in the bank, everything is a spiritual issue. Think of this from the perspective of God and eternity. Do not think of politics purely as politics. Think of what's behind it. Lies, scandal, immorality. Okay? What about the cause of God in America? When you vote, think of it as a spiritual issue. When you think about gun control or abortion, think of it as a spiritual issue. But then that leads to the next thing, and that is this. Spiritual issues must be decided by the revealed Word of God. Now, David has a revelation that we don't have. But we have a revelation that David doesn't have. We have the advent of Jesus Christ and the explicit teaching of His holy apostles. We have light that David doesn't have. And we have to take that and use it as the standard of all things. Politically speaking, what's going on right now in America is a battle of one form of Christianity versus another form of Christianity. There is an aberrant, heretical, existential neoliberalism that has infected our culture top to bottom. And it is a form of spiritual Dagon worship, okay, in our day and age that has infected our culture. It's a spiritual issue. Everything comes down to a spiritual issue. Think like David. This is about God. It's about God's reputation. It's about the reputation of Jesus Christ in His church. This is all about God. And learn to interpret it through the revelation of God's Word. Everything is a spiritual battle. And we have to think that way. It's easy to think of it in terms of your job or your rewards or your own personal ego. It isn't. These are spiritual issues. Think of them from that perspective. Questions or comments about today? All right, let's close in prayer. Father in heaven, we bless you and thank you for your word. We thank you for the example of your servant David, but ask that he would be an example to us. We especially thank you for the greater David, who saw all things, Father, through the light of the command that you had given him to be our Savior and our Redeemer and our Mediator. Everything, Father, was done for your glory. We ask that our greater example would be Jesus Christ, that we would live and think as he lived, as servants of you, the Most High God. Father, we pray that you would use us to defend your honor and the honor of your word, to defend the reputation of Jesus Christ and his church. We pray these things in his name. Amen.